welcome to Road Talk, Navigating Your Journey, where it is our mission to empower Christians with boldness and courage in every place. This is Jacob Hawk, the host of this podcast. You may be sitting in your car in traffic, walking in your neighborhood, exercising at the gym, or just trying to relax after a long day, but we are thrilled that you have joined us to spend time in God's Word. For more content, writings, podcasts, and other materials, I invite you to visit drjacobhawk.com. May God bless you richly and have a great day. Welcome back to Road Talk, Navigating Your Journey. Hope you're having a great day. Thank you for joining us for episode 133. We have been in a series talking about leadership, and today is the final episode in that series. We're going to talk about building the next generation of leaders, specifically what that process looks like, how we should do it. Marcus McKee is back with me today. Marcus, how are we doing today?
I am doing great. It is a nice day here in Dallas. It's going to be hot, though.
It is a beautiful morning. Marcus, I've enjoyed doing this series together the last few weeks.
I have thoroughly enjoyed it. I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you. It's been really nice talking about these things.
Well, I know that leadership is a topic you and I both love to read about and research and write about. So it's good to talk with someone who shares that interest. So today we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, building the next generation of leaders. Every church talks about this. Every business thinks about this. Every organization should be focusing on this idea of we want this thing, whether it be an organization or a congregation or business, to outlive us. So for that to happen, we've got to train people to take our place and while we're still here, help us along the way. So Marcus, first question, when we talk about training leaders, is there a specific process or formula that you think we should use for training the next generation of leaders?
I don't think there's necessarily a specific process or formula. I think it's boils down to things that we do to teach anybody effectively, and that is to love them, care for them, and then walk the talk. To train them is to take a vested interest in them. So it's not necessarily a formula, but you have to care about them. You have to take an interest in them. You have to love on them. You have to be patient. And then you have to do what it's going to take. And it may be different for each individual. Hmm. You know, you may see great potential in one person, and they're a quick study. They pick up on things very quick. Their aptitude to learn new subject matter is really good. Well, you may have somebody who is not necessarily that same person, but they have a natural charisma that people naturally want to follow. Well, you may have to take two different paths with those individuals, two different methods, so to speak. So I don't think it's just any one. I think you as the leader have to determine what it is for each individual person.
That's well said. One thing you mentioned kind of at the beginning of your answer, and it trickled through the whole answer, is taking a vested interest in people. So how much of training leaders do you think is built around noticing value in others that maybe they don't see in themselves?
I think that's a big piece of it because, you know, as a leader, your responsibility is to help people be better than what they think they can be. Mm-hmm. And it's helped pull that hidden talent out of them, or to pull that courage out of them that maybe they don't have because something's holding them back. But to see that, I think that is a huge piece of it, is you see something in somebody that they don't see themselves. You think God saw in Moses the ability to do things that Moses didn't see in himself.
Yeah.
You think about all through history, if you see people who are leaders are folks who can recognize the talents others have and yeah. not be intimidated by it. Because I think sometimes what happens is you may have leaders, they'll see something in somebody and they recognize that, but they may be hesitant to bring it out in them because they may view that person as a potential threat to their own leadership.
Yeah, I think the best training of leaders always begins with the shoulder tap. And, hey, we see something in you that we think is God-given, unique, and needs to be explored and matured and cultivated. And, you know, I know it works that way in preaching. There have been several young men through my life that I've kind of told, hey, there's something special in you, and you need to kind of consider, what does this look like for me in kingdom service? And it may not lead to full-time employment of a church, but you have a gift of teaching, or you have a gift of communication, or you have a gift of explaining things in a way where people can understand, that you need to use that gift, not just in your professional career, but also in equipping other people to follow the Lord.
It's like we see in somebody something they don't see in themselves, and then we encourage them along those paths, because anytime that we can have somebody in the kingdom recognize something special about themselves and encourage them to pursue that strength that they have, then the kingdom is stronger for it and better for it. Take 1 Corinthians 12, and then you take Romans 12, and Paul talks about the body is one and having different gifts and everybody having a different role to play. And that's, we all need that. We can't go and develop and tap all preachers, because we need preachers, but we also need people who are folks that are going to go and clean the buildings. And we need folks that are going to go and work all night to help clean up something from a disaster. That's, you know, we need all types and all looks, all feels, all generations, all demographics. Diversity is our friend.
Yeah. So I was just thinking, when you said, you know, part of leadership is seeing something in people they don't see in themselves, you could also say the opposite. Part of leadership is not seeing something in people that they think they do see in themselves, and helping people understand in a loving, tactful way at times, hey, man, like, I love your passion, but this may not be your gift. And maybe this passion can be harnessed in another area. There's just as much leadership in that as trying to bring something out of someone that they don't realize is there, is kind of stopping them and saying, let's tap the brakes on this and find another area for you to serve. That's a hard conversation, but it's an important conversation.
That's a very hard conversation, but like you said, it's important. It's helping them find their strength, right? You know, the poor individual who would ever come to me and say, hey, I think you'd make a great song leader, is somebody that I would look at them and go, what? No.
They may be hearing impaired.
Yes, they're definitely hearing impaired. They probably, yeah, absolutely. Their hearing aid wasn't turned up that day, because if you've ever had the misfortune of sitting beside me in church singing, I apologize, but, you know, it's those things where people can say, hey, maybe your gift's not in that, but there's some other things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that's what the conversation from leadership is about. It's like helping, you want to be good at something that you probably don't have a talent to be good at. So let's find that thing that you do have, and let's forward our efforts towards that and push towards that. Gallup has a whole thing around somebody's strengths, and the idea is soaring with your strengths. You take those strengths that you have, focus on those, and you're going to become better and more successful. Whereas if you focus on your weaknesses, the most you can ever do with something that you're weak at is maybe become mediocre at it, and then nobody wants mediocrity.
Right. I think Patrick Lencioni, in one of his books on leadership, said, we really don't understand what our strengths are until we define what our weaknesses are. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, because you can't know you're good at something until you recognize I'm bad at something. And when I finally admit I'm not good at this, everyone's good at something, that's what spurs you on to go figure out, what am I good at, once I figure out what I'm not good at. And I think sometimes we go about it the other way. We try to go figure out, hey, where am I gifted, before having some painful trial and error to figure out where I'm not gifted. And leaders, as you've well said already, I think navigate people through the trenches of success and failure. And the more failure you have, ultimately will lead to the more successful experience. So, yeah, that's a big part of training the next generation.
And I think with that, part of it is leaders don't give up on somebody. Maybe you see that somebody doesn't have a strength in an area, but they are bound and determined to go down that area. It's sometimes you have to let them walk down that area and fail. You don't let them hang themselves. You give them enough rope, but not enough to hang themselves. You help them do that, but you're patient with them and recognize that sometimes people have to experience that failure to really get it across the head, get it through that they're not good at something. And then when you're still there, mm-hmm. and they see that and that you haven't given up on them, then I found that there a lot of people are more receptive. I know I have been to leaders that have done that with me. I was so focused on something, and man, I just had it wrong. But I was bound and determined to be good at it, and you know, no, I wasn't. No matter what I threw at it, yeah. So. Yeah. But those leaders that said, yeah, okay, now that you got that out of your system, you're ready to do something that you're going to be good at. Yeah, let's go.
Why would you want to spend your entire life and energy training to be something at best that you're mediocre at? Why not invest your energy and passion and time into something that you're not just going to be good at, but you're going to be exceptional at?
And typically when you're exceptional at something, you're going to have a passion.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't. I think of certain people that, you know, you see this in athletes sometimes. They're maybe really good at something, but they have no love for it anymore because they've burnt themselves out. You know, I think of Andre Agassi and his story of just how he was this phenomenal, phenomenal tennis player in his youth. But he hated every minute of it. Mm-hmm. And he was still good at it, which imagine if he really loved it, how good he would have been. Mm-hmm. But it's the same thing for us. It's like, I get tickled sometimes, and I say tickled, it's in a sad way, is that when I see individuals who go into ministry because they're gifted public speaker, but they don't love people. Mm-hmm. And that's just for me. I get tickled, but it's in a sad tickle because if you don't love people, how can you minister to them? Mm-hmm. You may be a great public speaker, but it's not just about giving a sermon. You know, it's so much more, and you know that you've spent a lifetime being a minister. You get that, and
I think that's very well said. Let's pivot to the next question here. So when we're training people, we've got to find the balance between helping them grow and then showing them exactly how to do what they need to do. So this question, Marcus, how do we strike that balance between equipping someone and then just managing someone?
That is where an individual's leadership skill really comes in, I think. It separates the guys who and ladies who are mediocre at leadership versus those that are really good. Because those that are really good can see that difference. Because, again, it's different for each individual mm-hmm. that you have. It's understanding where people's limits are. And so understanding where that individual's limits are and being able to push them just beyond those limits so that they grow versus giving them step by step. And typically sometimes that will, I think, naturally come out in an individual, because if you're having to do things for them and constantly do their job for them, then something's amiss. Because you don't hire somebody to do a job and then you do it for them. You don't hire somebody to lead a team and then you end up having to lead it. You end up having to give it direction. You sometimes we do that, and that's bad on the leader. But if you're going to develop somebody, you have to give them the tools to do it and then get out of the way.
Yeah. I watched in the transition period of you coming to this position you're at now, I thought there was a lot of wisdom in what you and Scott Wolf did that you, I guess you came on March 1st.
I did.
And for a month, just kind of followed Scott around and watched everything he did. And then April rolled around and I joked with Scott, it looked like he was sitting in timeout for the entire month because he was sitting in the corner not doing anything, but he was there if you needed him. But you right. were kind of running the show April 1, and then May 1, Scott rode off into the sunset in the land of saltines and mayonnaise.
Yeah.
You know, but which is was his favorite snack.
Yes.
But now you had 60 days of 30 days of that just absorbing and 30 days of that leading with the training wheels, and then the training wheels came off. I don't know if that was his idea or your idea or a shared vision, but I thought there was a lot of wisdom.
That was Mr. Saltine and crackers and mayonnaise idea. So in case you don't know, Scott loved mayonnaise on saltines. He would take a saltine cracker, squirt his mayonnaise on it, and eat that like it was the best thing ever, and we would cringe. And every once in a while, he'd take a serrano pepper and eat that just raw and whole and then throw that in. So anyways, that's just more information you wanted to know. But it was Scott's idea. He had had enough time of developing people and helping them that he knew what it took, right? He knew himself. He knew the role. And then he knew me, and he knew what would set us up for success. I think, again, back to the leadership, the transition, the leader, Scott, in this place, knew himself. He knew how he operated best to train people. He knew me. And then he knew the job itself. And so he was able to do those things. And I've heard several people comment, you know, that it was a seamless transition in a lot of ways because of the wisdom that Scott had in bringing to this transition of leadership. And that was really good, I thought.
Kudos to both of you on that. So you made an interesting statement when I first asked this question. You said you have to know people's limits because every person's different. I wholeheartedly agree with that. Let me ask you to follow up with that question then. How do you know someone's limits?
That's a trial and error. When I mean trial and error is you have to push them. To test somebody's limits, you have to, have them stretch and grow. But you have to do it in a controlled environment, so to speak, when you're testing somebody's limits, because the worst thing that you can do as a leader, I think, is to test somebody's limits beyond what they're maybe capable of, and then they fail and it be a catastrophic fail, right? There's things where we all learn from our failures, but you never want to have somebody fail so bad that they can't recover from it. Mm-hmm. Especially, in business world, you want somebody to... You want to give them enough leeway to make decisions, and if they fail, to learn from it, but you never want them to fail where others notice it to a large extent, because then that could derail their career, and you do them more harm than good in giving them too much space. You knowing their limits, you test it, and then once you know that, you recognize when it's time for you to step in and protect them from themselves, mm-hmm. right? I think that's a big piece of leadership as well, is you may fight me on this and you may not like me for it, but as a leader, I know what's best for you. I know what's best for the organization. I'm making this decision, and later down the road, you'll see that it was the right decision and understand why I made it, but that's because I know your limits and I'm not going to set you up to fail in front of a group of leaders themselves.
So are you saying effective training follows the prerequisite of having a relationship with an individual you're training?
Absolutely. I think you have that relationship, you're able to train, you form that relationship during training and it grows stronger. You think about the military, what do? They push people to their limits, right? But they don't kill them. Right. But they'll take soldiers and push them to their limits. But They also know that some drill sergeants will push somebody harder than they push that somebody else, and wonder why is that? Well, it's because maybe the other person's not living up to their potential, and because that sergeant knows that person, has spent time around them, and has got a relationship with them, albeit a different relationship. It's not a lovey-dovey relationship or, hey, I'm your best buddy relationship, but it's a relationship nonetheless.
You know, most of my context has been working with churches and ministry, and I have done some, for lack of a better term, consulting, I guess, with churches in the past on training people to be Bible class teachers. Because every church that I'm aware of is always asking the question, how do we get more people willing to teach Bible class? Preston Crest is very blessed in that we have a deep bench of very skilled teachers. I would say we are in the minority on that for most
churches. It's the exception. We are blessed.
One thing I always talk about when I do this consulting with churches is I say it's a marvel to me that I'm comfortable speaking to audiences of any size, 5 people or 500 or 2,000, because my first experience public speaking, I was in second grade, and I was asked by my teacher to give a speech at like a school assembly, and I stood behind the podium, and I was so nervous. I'm grabbing a sheet of paper here in my office. My hands were shaking the whole time, and I could not read because my hands, and it took 4 or 5 years before I got up again in front of an audience because I was so scarred by that. The next time I got up, my dad had worked with me, and I was much more comfortable, and I knew the material better, and it was a great experience. But someone's first experience in teaching or speaking is going, for the most part, to define the trajectory of the rest of their experiences teaching, preaching, whatever it may be. And churches say, why can't we have more Bible class teachers? And my answer always is, because you threw them into the deep end of the pool. One, they didn't know how to swim. Two, there wasn't a lifeguard on duty. And at the very least, there wasn't even, you know, an inflatable tire for them to grab onto. It's like, just throw them out there and expect them to figure out, would you teach a quarter on Romans for us? And good luck.
And specifically Romans 9, I need you to dive into that for me. And
there's no curriculum, there's no guide, there's no meat to talk about the material. And so I say, you take baby steps. You know, maybe you start a training class at your church on teaching, or then maybe someone's first experience teaching is, let's co-teach, not even a week, just half the lesson with me. And then you kind of stair step into a system that they feel comfortable with. But if you just throw them into the deep water with no help, yeah, you're not going to have any teachers. And I think that's just a principle for leadership across the board. If you don't help people grow or stair-step them into where they want to go, they're going to quit and never do it again.
It kind of goes back to the beginning question is of a plan, for lack of a better term, to train people, to get them to approach leadership with a plan, to approach the development of those newer generations with a plan. And you do with each individual, you'll have a plan to do exactly what you're talking about. I'm training this person. They don't have a natural gift to speak in front of others, but they want to be a Bible class teacher. Well, where am I going to spend time? Well, I've got to show them how to study, but they're naturally gifted at that. They already do a lot of study. They're just not naturally gifted at the speaking piece. So now I need to help them. How do you help them see how they can engage an audience, how they can do that with class, and how that's different than giving a sermon, right? It's a Bible class, much different. And then if it's somebody that is a great speaker, they can engage a class, but they don't know how to study, then it's like, okay, well, let's go through, how are you studying? How are you preparing? How are you putting together your lesson? So it's all of those things that you said, and it's we do. You would think a Bible class of your church family, and I say that because this supposedly and should be people that are in your corner. They're your cheerleaders. They want you to do well. They're going to be your biggest supporters, but oftentimes they're the toughest folks to talk to, because they will let you know if you don't get it right, and if you misquoted, oh, that was supposed to be a, not the, in that scripture you quoted, you messed it up. So,
well, the phrase, which I've heard in Bible classes before, I'm sure you have as well, it says what it means and it means what it says. That's not the most effective or engaging way to teach a Bible class. So we can do a little bit better than that. Okay, let's jump to the last question here. It's kind of similar to the second question, but a little bit different. So we've been training people. We've had the relationship with them. We've stair-stepped them into their growth. When do we know that it's officially time to let go of the wheel and let someone else drive?
Again, it's different for each individual, but I think what I've seen very effectively from best leaders that I've worked with is when they have not had to be involved in the process. Because all along that process, you're training them, you're giving them certain things, you're doing things, and you're helping them this, and you're showing them, and you're teaching, guiding, whatever it may be. And then when they can do it with little to no guidance, little to no help from you as a leader, then you'll see that. And you can observe that in how those that are around them are reacting to them as well. And you can see that, because if you're able to watch them in a room with those that they're leading, is that team responding to the individual? Is that team looking like they'll be willing to follow where she or he takes them?
Yeah. I know another preacher, a friend of mine that's been in ministry for, he's approaching 50 years of it. And I've heard him say on numerous occasions that at this phase of his life, his greatest focus is, I want to finish well. I want to finish well. Because a lot of leaders, again, I'm kind of speaking from the lens of ministry, but I think this is true for people in business, CEOs, presidents of universities, whatever it is. Sometimes people stay on board too long, and the last few years of their employment or their leadership are not as good as, you know, the 5 or 6 years before that. And I think there's a lot of wisdom and discernment in saying, I want to finish well. I want to go out at the top of my game, and I want to finish before I start my decline. Because you want to finish on a high note. You don't want to finish because things are declining and I've waited too long to step out.
Right. I mean, you look at Moses, and Bible says he had not lost his eyesight, his vigor, or anything. He was like a man that was 40 years younger, or mm-hmm. or even more than that, and he was 120 years old. He could have kept going. You know, the situation dictated that he handed over to Joshua, but even then, Moses was still at the top of his game. And that's exactly what we want to do. It's that wisdom and understanding. It's time for me to hand it off to the next person, because I want to be remembered for that. I think that's wisdom in that, because you can do more damage in those last few years if you're in to lead people and it take to in the wrong way, and then the guy coming behind you or the lady coming behind you has to, man, they have to recorrect all
yeah,
of that.
They have to spend the first few years of their leadership fixing problems you created. And I think even people who are most passionate about certain endeavors, eventually all passion begins to die. And when you're no longer excited to get up and do it in the morning, it's maybe time to think about the next phase, yeah. Or next chapter.
And even if your passion hasn't waned, good wisdom, good leadership involves wisdom, being self-aware. That's one of the key things for any good leaders. They have to be self-aware, and it's being self-aware enough to say, am I effective at what I'm doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I somebody that, if I'm leading a group of younger generation people and I'm, you know, older generation, am I effective with them, or do they need someone who is more along their generational lines and knowing that, to, when to step away?
Well, Marcus, I have thoroughly enjoyed this discussion.
Yes, been very enjoyable. Love it.
Again, we are thrilled you're at Preston Crest and thankful that you are helping to lead our ministry team here. As always, thank you for spending some of your time today with us at Road Talk. Keep your eyes on heaven, and I can't wait to talk with you next time. God bless. Have a great day.